Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 74 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, today, please, you'll have to excuse my voice. I am a couple of days into a bout of flu or COVID or something, God only knows. I'm almost certain, though, that the kids brought it back from school. Anyway, life goes on, and I've got another dispatch for you from Dubai today. And it's also another returning guest, like last week, Stefan Levera, well known to those of you who are in the Bitcoin world. The last time we spoke was over a year ago in episode 4 when I ran into him in El Salvador. This week, we're on his home territory. Well, adoptive home, at least. He relocated to the UAE 2 years ago, and in this conversation, we discuss that move and why the Emirates have been so successful at attracting foreign talent over the last few years. Other topics discussed include the demise of the Western world, monarchies, multiculturalism, inflation, and Stefan gives us a roundup of the latest developments in the world of Bitcoin. Don't forget, you can reach out via Telegram, Patreon, or our website. And while you're here, I have a little favor to ask. Would you, by any chance, please briefly pause this recording and pop over to your podcasting app and drop us a review? Many thanks in advance. We really do appreciate all the feedback, and I'm told it helps to increase the visibility of the show. We're all working towards the same goal, and spreading the word is one small part of that, which I, for one, consider to be of great importance. Anyway, I'll be brief before my voice literally stops in its tracks. So why don't you, in the time-honored tradition of this podcast, please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Stefan Levera. So, and here you can speak from personal experience then, because you've moved to a place that has been hugely successful in the implementation of free zones and free economic zones. What do you think it is that a country needs to do to attract people such as yourself or anyone really? I mean, in your case, you're in Dubai. What was it about Dubai that attracted you?
So for me, low taxes, safety, convenience, good quality services, these were all draw cards, location as well. So obviously that will matter depending on where is your family. Like as an example for me with Dubai, you know, flying to Sri Lanka or other parts of Asia is relatively fast. So that will vary depending on where you are, where your family's from. But I would say safety is a really important part. And I think that's what we're seeing. I mean, even pointing at El Salvador, thinking about how much it was a bad situation there in terms of crime. And then now that the crime is very low there, that's enticed a lot more people to come back, whether they were Salvadoran diaspora or whether it's tourists or just people who are fleeing Canada or somewhere. Now they're going to El Salvador. And I think a similar thing here with Dubai and the UAE generally is it's quite a safe place. And I can tell you, my wife loves that it's really safe here. Like, so maybe, you know, even if you're an investor or an entrepreneur, but actually, what does your wife like as well? If your wife really likes the fact that it's safe here, well, then maybe I was really interested in the low taxes, and maybe my wife liked the safety factor.
Talking about El Salvador, we've asked a few people about this and haven't really got a good answer. But do you know what's going on with Bitcoin City at the moment? What's the latest?
I don't really know, to be honest. I think the impression, here's the impression I get just from looking at the news. Bukele and his administration just seem to be focused on slowly but surely making the overall country more attractive to outside investors and entrepreneurs and people. So we see them trying to lower the taxes on things. They have this, I think they took the taxes down from 30% to 0%. And I think they are now, can be considered more like a territorial tax country. So people who live in El Salvador but have income from outside El Salvador, that income outside El Salvador is not taxed. And so that can be a real draw card as well, because you might be an investor, an entrepreneur, a person who has business interests around the world, and you might not want to, you might want to spend time there but not get taxed on your ventures that are outside the country. Whereas other countries will have this worldwide global taxation net, let's say, or this remit or scope. They'll say, you live here, you're taxed on your worldwide income. So that's another factor. We're seeing, you know, obviously the safety part we spoke about. I think we're seeing also these efforts being made around things like the citizenship program that they had. So basically you could pay $1 million either in Bitcoin or in Tether, I believe. And you could basically get a passport, but they were restricting that, right? They're saying this is only for 1,000 families. So I guess they're trying to sort of thread the needle there of having a citizenship program, but not making it so openly broad that other countries could start to have a concern about it. As we saw in some of the citizenship by investment programs in the Caribbean, some of the EU countries were sort of arcing up about that, saying, oh, what, you're selling the, you know, selling passports, you need to, whatever, you need to do more due diligence, or you need to raise your prices, you need to do this, that, and the other. Maybe El Salvador have, in that way, tried to thread the needle of, you know, accepting investment, but without hindering the quality of their already existing passport by saying, oh, look, see, it's a very high level of investment. You can't, it's not just anyone who can just come in and buy this passport, etc. I mean, that's just one example. But there are other things that you could argue that the country is doing to try to improve things. As an example, the Bitcoin office, Max Keiser and Stacey there, and I think Stacey Herbert there, is really trying to help sort of push along directions that make investment into the country easy.
It's interesting because one of the things I've worked out from doing, like, whatever, 15 interviews about special economic zones is one of the sort of like important attributes of them is that they are testing grounds for policy within a country. When a country, say like Shenzhen's a good example, you know, you can't go from communism to some kind of a free market overnight in a whole country. So they set up these small zones to test out the policies, which worked, and then slowly but surely they rolled it out into the rest of the country. I think Dubai's often is doing kind of the same thing. But El Salvador seems to be just doing it for the whole country. I'm surprised they haven't gone down the special economic zone route themselves. And that's why I was asking about Bitcoin City, because it's like, I thought that's kind of what that was going to be, a part of the country which was going to, you know, try out some new rules and regs maybe. But they just seem to be rolling these things out. Is that a correct assumption? Do you think?
I mean, I don't have any inside info, but in terms of, I'm looking at the country just as an outsider as well, that seems to be what they're doing, right? It seems to be that's the direction they're trying to go. And Bukele has spoken publicly about his desire to turn El Salvador into a Singapore, like the Singapore of, let's call it Central America, or South America. The measures he's trying to take are just geared at improving the overall country. But maybe they will still do this Bitcoin City thing as well. But maybe that's, it seems that's kind of on the back burner. Who knows?
Okay, so let's talk about Dubai and describe life in Dubai.
So I think it's really cool from the low tax and melting pot aspect that you can meet all kinds of people. There are interesting people here, whether they are entrepreneurs, investors, whatever interest group you're into, you can probably meet interesting people here. And I think that's actually a really interesting draw card. And what you'll see is that there are very wealthy people, and they could go live almost anywhere on earth. But why is it that they choose to either live in Dubai or maybe have a place in Dubai? Maybe they don't spend the whole year here in Dubai, but they might have a place here or have a residence permit here. Why do they do that? Well, I think it's because they like the networking aspect of it. They like the social, I mean, we're social creatures. We like to interact with each other. And maybe that's also an important factor, is who's, you know, who's there? Who's going there? Who's hanging out there? Who's spending time there? Some of that maybe is being driven by, like, you can see this influencer culture of like people on YouTube or Instagram or whatever. But I think part of it is also just you can meet interesting people. You can meet interesting entrepreneurs and investors and have interesting discussions. And that makes it more, you know, more worthwhile.
Interestingly, I've been coming to and from the UAE for quite a number of years, almost 10 years, I suppose. But this particular time we came, Peter put a reel out on Instagram that we were coming to Dubai. And the first time ever, three people who I know said, "Oh, you're coming to Dubai? I'm here right now." I think there's been a small resurgence of people coming to Dubai again recently. Is that true? I mean, you're here.
I would say post-COVID, yeah, we've seen a big rise in the number of people who either live here or spend time here. And part of that is, I think, Dubai and the UAE came out of the COVID tyranny era in a good light because they were relatively open. And in a loose sense, Dubai is kind of like a Switzerland, right? It's sort of neutral and people can come here. And so when there is trouble elsewhere around the world, whether it's the Russia-Ukraine conflict or something else, people come to Dubai. It's one of the places that they can still go to, and they can put their money there, they can buy a place, they can, etc. So as you know, a lot of Russian people moved here to Dubai in the last few years. Now, maybe some of those people are going to move back to Russia, but you know, wherever there's conflict or something going wrong elsewhere in the world, people can just come here and do business here, and it's sort of relatively neutral. And I think maybe that's something that the rulers of UAE have done well with. They've just sort of said, let's create a place that's good for business and let people come here and invest here.
Do you think brain drains are a real thing?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think brain drain is a very real factor. What happens is in countries and places that do not serve high performing or talented individuals, they will lose people. And we're seeing this. We're seeing news articles about this. I saw recently, even maybe a year ago, there were articles showing how Norway's wealthiest people were leaving Norway to go to Switzerland because of the taxes. I'm hearing, as another example, on the crime front, we're seeing in Sweden, people are attacking well-known, let's say, crypto or, you know, Bitcoin wealthy people. And so some of those people in Sweden are looking for a way out because maybe they don't want to be in these countries where it's sort of relatively easy to find out somebody's home address and that kind of thing. So the safety aspect, again, is playing into it as well. And that's attracting, you know, this brain drain factor, as you mentioned. I think it's also opportunities. It's just like, are there economic opportunities in the country that you're in? And how easy is it to get into somewhere like Dubai? And I think Dubai and the UAE have been relatively good about making it feasible for somebody to come to Dubai, as long as you know, you're not a criminal and you're not, you know, doing, you know, wrong things. You can come here and you can invest here, you can work here, and you can, generally speaking, earn more here than you would. Maybe not everybody, right? Maybe certain people in the Western world, depending on their career, depending on their profession, they may not earn more here. But there are a lot of people who otherwise would not be earning that much. People from India, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Pakistan, you know, parts of Europe, they can earn a lot more here than they would in their home country.
Where were you living before Dubai?
Australia, Sydney.
Australia, Sydney. So describe the difference in opportunity or lifestyle or whatever between Sydney and Dubai.
Yeah, so my main reason for leaving was around my anger at the lockdowns and the travel bans and all of this that was going on in Australia at the time I left. But honestly, I think the low taxes and the opportunities that are available here in Dubai also, also are a big draw card, especially if your income can be from remote, like from elsewhere around the world. It allows you to sort of do this aspect of earning money overseas, but spending locally in a place where, okay, the cost of living in Dubai is, let's say, higher than, you know, parts of Asia or some other places, but it's still cheaper than some of the big world cities like a London or a New York or places like that. And still cheaper than Sydney, I would say, here in Dubai, depending on how you live, of course. So that's definitely an interesting thing. I would say there are certain changes you need to be comfortable with. So with Dubai, I mean, it's quite literally, we're living in the desert, right? But, and people go around on highways to, from one place to another in Dubai. And so maybe it's not as, let's say, walkable or let's say public transportable as, let's say, a Sydney or other parts of the world where they have more like a subway and a metro and it's kind of more connected. But at the same time, there are opportunities here too, right? Especially if you can work from home, especially if you are living in certain parts of Dubai, right? So in Dubai, you might be in JBR or near Marina, and that's a very walkable part of Dubai. A lot of the very wealthy people, they live out on the Palm. Of course, we're here in this Business Bay downtown area. That's also another hub and arguably a little bit more walkable. But and then there are all these other communities out there where pretty much you need to drive or get a taxi, that kind of thing. So there are certain differences in the lifestyle. Obviously, it's a lot hotter here, right? It can be really hot in the middle of the year here in Dubai, in the UAE. But so long as you're okay with certain trade-offs around that, you can get more opportunities. You can have lower taxes. You can be safer. You can enjoy a different style of life. And I think, especially for people who are maybe getting a little annoyed about, let's say, some of the more woke aspects, the more leftist aspects in the Western world, right? America, Canada, UK, Australia, these kinds of countries, you don't have as much of that woke stuff here in the UAE. So I think that's also an interesting, that could also be interesting.
I think one of the plans when, you know, the concept of what was going to go on here was being dreamt up in the 80s, etc., was that the UAE should serve, in particular Dubai, obviously, as a hub for people. You know, is that something you consider it's doing well here?
Absolutely. I would say Dubai is a hub. I think statistically speaking, Dubai's airport is the number one international arrivals airport. And I think they just hit a new record even last year on the calendar year basis. So, yeah, quite literally, it is the number one international hub from that perspective. It's big from a tourism perspective. And so there are many reasons people are either having some kind of residence or permit here, or they live here, or they even just pass through for one reason or another, whether it's for a conference, whether it's to see friends, whether it's to do networking, whether it's to do business here. We're seeing more and more of that. And I think we see that. I'm involved with the Bitcoin meetup here as well. And we, you know, there's always people just coming through. And so that's interesting for us as well. Like whatever community you're in, there's a good chance there'll be people flying through and, you know, it's just an interesting place. So people from all around the world come through.
Do you think it could have been anywhere in the world? Like I'm interested to know whether there's such a thing as a first mover advantage with a place like Dubai. Obviously it's well positioned to be a hub, but they did use special economic zones to attract, for example, the financial district. They literally sucked.
Right. Yeah, people, DIFC, right?
Right. The DIFC was hugely successful in attracting financial institutions to come here. For you personally, could it have been anywhere? I mean, do you mind the fact that you're in the desert? Is it just, okay, we're in the desert, who cares?
Yeah, I mean, as long as the services are great. I mean, think of it like this. You can get high-speed internet and aircon and all the other services are there. So I think every country has its advantages and disadvantages. And I think, like you said, the UAE, in terms of positioning, is quite fortunate, right? It's close to Asia and it's close to Europe. So, and of course, Middle East. So I think that's why you see a lot of people come from, let's say, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, because it's not that far and there's all this economic opportunity. But you know what? People could do special economic zones and, you know, these kind of prosperity zones or whatever we're calling them, free cities, anywhere on earth, and people local to that area might go there for jobs, for investment, to set up a business. So yes, it's true that Dubai had some advantages in its position in the, you know, in the global, you know, geography. People have this stat, I think 4 or 5 billion people are within like a 6-hour flight or something. I can't remember the exact stat, but it's interesting that Dubai, and if you think about that radius of flight around how close many people are, and that makes it easy for it to be a hub, because then people can go there for work and then come back to see their family back in their home country. So that element obviously helps, but at the same time, I think there's so much opportunity for better governance around the world, right? Instead of governments adopting the attitude that the EU has of just regulating anything that moves, if they take an opportunity to say, let's actually have low tax, let's try to take a light touch regulation approach or no regulation approach and see what develops. And then maybe there'll be opportunities that come from that. Maybe there'll be all these people who flock here. Maybe there'll be all this investment that comes here. Maybe there'll be all these jobs there. And that is something that, I think most politicians and most, you know, government individuals would be for, right? I mean, you're trying to create win-win-win. Whereas the view I see in, you know, admittedly as an outsider, but if I look at the at places like the EU, they look like the worst. They look like they're just trying to regulate anything and everything. And they are almost seeing it like, oh, just by regulating something, that's innovating. But really, I think that's probably one of the worst examples where we're seeing massive regulation and it's harming the EU. It's harming Europeans massively. And sadly, many of them don't understand it. And so many of them are sort of on this track to just become poorer. They will experience stagnation, whereas other parts of the world and other countries will be growing rapidly. Now, yes, you could say, okay, maybe some of these other places are coming from a lower starting point, but pretty soon, and by soon I mean kind of on the decade time scale, some of these other nations and free zones will really start to challenge the, let's say, old world or the old wealth countries like in Europe.
If you could pick a place to establish a kind of Dubai-like zone anywhere in the world, where would you choose?
If it was possible, sure. I grew up in Sydney, Australia, so maybe that I have some attachment there. So if you could create Dubai but in Sydney, hey, that would be cool, because then I could have all my family and friends, you know, and have all those other aspects of it. But, you know, the realities of it are that I think it took certain kinds of governance to make Dubai what it is. And I think one example of that is they were strict on crime and they would deport people. They would deport criminals, right? Like, that was one aspect where maybe that would be hard to replicate in other parts of the world. Maybe that's just going to be hard to do, right? Just speaking honestly. And so if I think from a governance perspective and I look around the world, it's interesting that we see, you know, coming back to the El Salvador example, we're seeing some of these, let's call them human rights or more leftist organizations are criticizing Bukele, saying, oh, look at you, you're whatever. It's like, I know you've turned the country from being the murder capital to being one of the safest countries, but, you know, you're locking up all these criminals and maybe, you know, and they're sort of creating this kind of big, oh, you're contradicting democracy or something like this. But in reality, the people on the ground in El Salvador are voting for Bukele because he's made the place better. You know, I think there's this lack of awareness sometimes. And I think what we're seeing in parts of America as well is people call it the anarcho-tyranny, right? Like the people whose rights are meant to be defended, they're not being defended. And if it's easy for the police to go after you, especially if it was during the COVID tyranny years, they'll go after you for that, but they won't let's say somebody is trying to, defend other people on the subway from being attacked. The guy who intervenes to stop the attacker, he's the one who's going to jail and, you know, being walked out of the courthouse. Everyone's seen that famous image with the guy, you know, hands behind. Why is the Western world doing this, right? They're just shooting themselves in the foot, and they are encouraging the worst kinds of behaviors. They are decriminalizing theft below, what is it, $1,000 in San Francisco. And I know they sort of walk some of that back, but the point is they are criticizing other countries for trying to make a safe place while at the same time turning their own places less safe and less secure in their own property rights. And as you might have seen recently, the recent examples in New York around squatting rights, right? So this is kind of a big thing on the news, and the people who own the home are being arrested or being sent into these ridiculous bureaucracy nightmares while the squatters are being defended. And this is kind of this leftist sort of ideology of, oh, landlords are evil, and this kind of idea. And to me, that's just ridiculous. It comes down to, are you defending private property rights?
I mean, I was going to ask you, why do you think that's happening? I agree that there are plenty of examples, and some of what's going on, certainly in California, for example, does seem quite rather strange, especially if you compare it to the UAE. And obviously, the UAE has its own problems, but they're very different from the problems you see somewhere like California. Why do you think California's... What is the rationale behind these kind of things? Do you know?
Hard to say. I mean, some people say it's George Soros and he's supporting, you know, certain leftist DA, district attorneys, and, you know, these kinds of things.
You've still got to believe in the ideas, though. I mean, like, take the decriminalization of... Was it $900?
Yeah, anything? I think it was like $950 or $1,000.
Something like that. Like in one, this is how, like, I'm looking at it thinking, okay, right, that decreases bureaucracy somewhat. That's about the only advantage I can see there. It does seem completely absurd otherwise, though. So it doesn't matter who's funding you. You still got to kind of believe in the policy. Why do you think that particular policy happened, for example?
So it could argue that there's been this big march through the institutions, right? This idea of, like, over time, the universities, Hollywood, All these institutions are being captured. And so when we step back and think from a governance perspective, right, people talk about this idea of trying to defend the rights of the minority, right? And they try to say, well, let's have, you know, okay, so if you're thinking about country governance and you have the executive, the judiciary, and the legislative, and the idea or the theory being, okay, yeah, it's a democracy, but we're meant to protect some of your rights because there's these three arms of the government, they're meant to keep each other in check. But in practice, that doesn't actually happen over the long term. Why? Because eventually, the people you're voting for still decide who's in the Supreme Court, right? So in the American case, you could say, well, yeah, you're still voting on the legislative arm of the state, and then those people choose who goes into the judiciary. And those people can have all kinds of crazy Marxist, leftist ideas, and so it doesn't actually defend the rights of minorities. And so that's maybe another way to understand that paradigm, is that just over time, they've managed to get so much anti-private property rhetoric and so much, you know, whatever reason they'll frame it, right, anti-colonialism or anti-whatever, you know, ideas. And then you get all these judges who believe in those crazy ideas. And so then now you're stuck with no real defense of private property rights.
So in the case of the ability to steal less than nine, not being charged for less than $900 worth of goods, for example. Are you saying that because the kind of people that need to steal are going to necessarily be disadvantaged people? So are they the ones that need protecting, therefore this is a way we can protect those people? Do you think that is the rationale? Is that what you're saying, kind of thing?
Hard to say. I mean, I don't think I have a good answer. Like, I don't think I understand all the dynamics of it, but I think, to me, the way I'm sort of, if I were to zoom out a bit and look at things, it's more that, you know, high taxes and high regulation and minimum wage laws and all these, and occupational licensing laws, all of these things have contributed to a society where people can't make ends meet. And because of that, then, okay, yeah, you're starting to see these, the theft and all this kind of thing. And antisocial behaviors are being encouraged, right? Instead of a normal free society where you discourage antisocial behaviors like theft and murder and rape and crime, this kind of thing, some of these behaviors are not being discouraged anymore. And that can be a really bad thing if you just let that play out, because now there's a lot more theft happening. And then what does that cause? It causes like this kind of negative spiral, because maybe now some of the shops, their insurance premiums have risen a lot, or maybe they leave. And so then you end up with this kind of spiral, downward spiral, because now the shops don't even set up there. And so now it's kind of, now locals, genuine, you know, good working locals can't even access goods that they need. And so now they're stuck with, you know, worse quality. And so it just kind of becomes this downward spiral, and you end up with this kind of two-class society where like the millionaires and the billionaires of San Francisco are sort of like, oh, I don't see it. It doesn't matter to me. And they live in their own little bubble. And then all the masses out there, they're kind of struggling. That, you know, that seems to be the two-tier society that's being created.
Or one I saw the other day, I think it was in America, was a news article where somebody from a local government position was advising people to leave their car windows down so that when the car got robbed, the window wasn't smashed. Was it America? I can't remember.
Yeah, I think that is San Francisco. That's like standard advice in San Francisco, apparently. So, you know, I think it just comes down to, do you really think about the long term, you know, and do you really, you know, a lot of these politicians are just acting in a very short term mindset. And if they could really act longer term, they could see that some of these things they're doing might superficially look like they help in the short term, but they hurt in the long term.
I mean, that's an interesting, because the UAE seems to have a pretty long term perspective. Can you talk a bit about that? Why do you think that is?
I think there's an elephant in the room here. I think part of it is the fact that it's a monarchy. And I think people have this idea that democracy is an unalloyed good. You're not allowed to criticize democracy. And you know, democracy is a synonym for good in the world today. And you're not allowed to criticize. But actually, yeah, I'm going to criticize democracy. I think democracy does, especially in the world we have today, it encourages the worst people to rise to the top. Whereas monarchy, look, it's not a guarantee. It's not saying every monarchy will always be an amazing place to live. But speaking in terms of tendencies, I think a monarch cares more about the long term than a democratically elected politician. And the system that the democratically elected politicians create. And so I would say a monarch treats his territory, his state, like something to be grown for the long term. And he wants to pass it down to his son, or to his sons. So he cares about the long run. He's not like a Democrat mindset, or he's not in this sort of bureaucrat mindset where they try to control things without having an ownership stake. For them, it's more like, hey, I'm here for 3 or 4 years, let me get whatever I can, and then I'm out, you know? Or if you're a bureaucrat, yeah, okay, just like, you look good by having a big department underneath you. It doesn't matter that much about like you actually being a good, you know, regulator or a good bureaucrat. It's kind of just a box-ticking exercise. So I would say that long-term approach of favoring private property rights, I think, is what makes these places better. And we're going to see that. I think we're going to see that as more and more, you know, free cities and more of these free zones come up, they will offer opportunities. And so what we'll see is free zones all around the world. And then locals in areas near that free zone will sort of be like, hey, there's jobs there. Let me, you know, commute into there, work there, and then come back out at home. And then I think what we'll start to see is those free zones will then start enlarging, or there'll be more of them around the world. And so that will help with the proliferation of this kind of idea of, hey, let's prove out that it works. So that's kind of how I'm seeing it. I think to summarize, it's that I think a monarch cares more about the long run than a democratically elected politician. But the ideal case would be if we could just privatize everything. I understand that's you know, that's going to be a while before we get there. But you know what? I will also say this. In 2019, if you would ask me, like, hey, how much will things change? I might have thought, look, certain things will change, but you know, there's kind of like this Overton window of what's possible. Post 2020, so much has changed. And I think the Overton window has just been blown wide open. Now's the time to be talking about these big ideas, because now we could actually see some area, some territory, some free state or some free zone really outcompete others. Because, you know, the Overton window is so big, it's just been enlarged now. And so, yeah, I think now's the time to start thinking about these bigger ideas.
Let's talk a little bit about... Oh, yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you, actually. Can you describe the community here in Dubai? Who do you hang out with? Who do you mix with? You know, because presumably you didn't know many people when you came here, did you?
I mean, yeah, I mean, I made friends with the Bitcoin community. Obviously, I'm in the Bitcoin world, so I made friends that way. There's also an Austrian economics meetup. And so those are a few examples. And then from there, you just sort of friends of friends of friends, and then you sort of make groups. And
So who's here, like, you know, in general, and compare and contrast with, say, Sydney, for example?
Yeah. Okay. So it's, well, as people know, Dubai is about 90%. I don't know the exact number. It's in that range, about 90% expat. It's only about 10% local Emiratis. So it is naturally more of a melting pot. You're just naturally going to see, you know, people from all around the world. And the funny thing is, people sometimes criticize the idea of multicultural. Maybe this is another point, but let me answer your question first before I get to that other point around multiculturalism. But the people you meet here, generally speaking, there's intelligent, you know, entrepreneurs and investors and expat workers, right? People who are working, or they came here for work. And then I find a lot of options there in terms of who you network with, who you actually spend time with. And I think that's really cool, like whether you are doing lunches and brunches and dinners and things with people. And so, yeah, I just think there's lots of opportunities depending on, you know, what thing you're into, what communities you run in, what circles you run in. But I have found it relatively easy to make new friends and, you know, make a social circle here. But I guess that's one criticism sometimes people have. They say maybe it's a bit transient, or because people, there's kind of always a churn of people coming in and going. But I know that the leaders, you know, the rulers of Dubai are trying to make it more a place that you can settle down. And now they've got programs like the Golden Visa, that kind of thing, so that people can actually set down a little bit more of a root, some more roots here. So, yeah, I mean, I've been here for, 2 years and 3 months-ish, around that. And yeah, in that time, I've found it pretty good in terms of being able to, you know, make friends and make connections.
You started talking about multiculturalism and the downside of it.
Oh, right, yeah. So I think if you look to the political debates that are happening elsewhere around the world, you're getting these debates around, oh, multiculturalism and, you know, it doesn't work, this, that, and the other. But I would say Dubai is actually an interesting contrast or counterpoint there. Why? Because I think Dubai might have set the expectation about crime, and then now people are able to interact and not necessarily have to, you know, deal with the same issues that you get with multiculturalism in some of the Western parts of the world, where maybe the ground rules were not established of like what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do. And so what we see in other parts of the world is, yeah, you get this phenomenon of maybe people moving in and then bringing their local conflict into that other country, you know, this kind of thing, where I think because in Dubai they were more strict about crime and sort of strict about what you're allowed to do or advocate. And because, here's the other point, again, it comes back to it's not a democracy. Because I think what happens in some of the other countries is, yeah, you do get this dynamic of people coming here and then voting to sort of turn it back into into the place that they came from. Whereas here in Dubai, you don't vote. So I think maybe that's another element where you sort of, now, yes, you're putting a little bit more trust into the idea that the leaders, the rulers are going to rule appropriately, but it also means maybe they're less susceptible to this kind of political to-ing and fro-ing that happens normally, right? And I think this is another interesting point that might be interesting here is I've heard of this dynamic where people from elsewhere around the Middle East, when they're back in their home country, let's say like a Lebanese person is like arguing about the political system in Lebanon or whatever, but when he's here in Dubai, he's just here making money. You know, so it's sort of like, there's this funny dynamic where you take the same person, but put them into a different governance or a different environment, and that same person is now acting differently. Why is that, right? So it's sort of interesting that people who are from countries where maybe there is a lot of political argumentation and turmoil about this, that, and the other, but actually when they come to places like Dubai, they just come here, they make their money, and they're focused on their business and their family, and that's it. And so I think that that's also worth considering, right? Like maybe that's another thing that free zones, free private cities, whatever we're calling them, they can benefit from that dynamic of saying, look, we don't have politics here, we just have business, and here's the ground rules, right? It's business and here's the ground rules. So we don't need this kind of other political debates about, you know, who gets this and who gets that and what whatever. It's more just like, no, private property is, you know, private property is the, I think, the important consideration.
I've heard, there's a few things I wanted to talk about there. I've heard from other people that say part of the reason why you don't get as much strife here in Dubai is because it's almost 100% employment rate amongst people that want to get employed. You know, you don't, and that keeps everyone happy. It keeps everyone right. Moving. But talking about back to monarchy, and because it's really interesting, obviously you get bad monarchs. And you can never predict a bad monarch through. But you could easily argue that currently, in its current state, the UAE, if a bad monarch did appear, there'd be quite a mass exodus before too long. You would have thought. Because presumably they know that. And I've heard from someone else during this interview process that... And he said to us, he really did feel like he was being thought about as a resident in Dubai. Do you know what I mean? He felt like he was the customer.
Right. Yeah.
Is that real? Do you feel that as well?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is another, you know, I think certain countries are trying to be competitive. They're actually taking it seriously and treating people like customers. And I would say places like El Salvador and places like Dubai in the UAE are doing that. I think arguably when they take this mindset of we want to attract people and we want to attract customers, naturally they're thinking more along the lines of what is going to make this a better place to live, to invest, to work, to do business. Whereas in much of the world, the democratic world, let's say, you're stuck with this mindset of everyone's just trying to take. Right, people are just trying to take or regulate. They're just sort of like, and they sort of treat it like, oh, I'm just going to rest on my laurels. I'm just going to like, you know, I'm just going to take private entrepreneurs for granted, right? I'm just going to assume they're going to keep working hard and I can just keep taxing and regulating them. And I think that's not going to work out well for a lot of the, let's say, the Western world. Yes, they're coming from a high, but they're starting from a very high position, like if you talk about today, yes. They've accumulated a lot of wealth, but I think they're going to stagnate relatively compared to other countries. And so they're going to lose out, especially coming back to that brain drain factor. What you need is those top 1-5%, those are the people who really, really move the needle, right? Because they're the ones paying, you know, they're the ones setting up businesses, and they're the ones who end up paying so much tax in the Western world. And now those people are getting attracted to places that are offering them a better deal.
I think America's almost the best example of that, you know, huge barrier to entry and huge barrier to exit as well. They really do take people for granted, and you can obviously, in a way, quite rightly so. Everyone wants to go there, apparently. But you're right, their competitive advantage will wane relatively quickly. I mean, I don't know whether you've noticed this, but since we've been in the Middle East, everyone's talking about Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
It's the new place that is changing daily in so many ways. The projects like NEOM and the other things that they're planning in Saudi, and just everyone is looking at this place now as a place that's reforming, that's turning into the new hub or the new place. What have you heard about Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, so I think it's, as you said, from what I hear, Saudi Arabia is really trying hard to develop. Now, it's not like Dubai, it's more like they're trying to be like a Dubai in certain ways. So, and maybe in like a few decades, they'll sort of be at the level. But for now, or maybe in like a decade, let's say. But yeah, definitely I'm hearing this increased competitiveness aspect coming out of Saudi Arabia. I know that, you know, I don't know the details, but I've heard they're trying to do things like have free zones and tax advantages and things like this. So I anticipate the Middle East is just in general going to become a more competitive place and rise in prominence. Places like Qatar, Oman, Saudi Arabia, UAE are all, I think, sort of going, but yeah, most prominently the UAE, and I think Saudi Arabia is really trying to compete now. And in a way, that's kind of a good thing for people who live in the area, because now they've got more choices, right? If one particular place is not doing so well or not offering a good governance structure, hey, go somewhere else.
Can you speak a little bit to the life cycle of a governance structure, in as much as you were alluding to earlier? Dubai is in this, or the UAE is in this moment where it's seeing residents as customers, and say the UK is seeing residents as...
You're a subject, right? You're,
yeah, or tax...
You're a tax cattle.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Is that a natural life cycle? Because I'm sure...
Maybe. Maybe there is something to that. Like maybe there's kind of like a, you know, in the really early days, it's really undeveloped, but it's like super low regulation, low taxes, and just kind of anything goes. And then over time, maybe there's like a maturation process. And then after time, you know, after some time, it sort of, then it starts to bring in more taxes and regulation, and then it starts to have more bureaucracy, and then it sort of fades into becoming, it sort of settles into, let's say, you know, what we've seen. Maybe that life cycle does exist. I don't really know.
Well, I mean, Dubai has introduced a 5% VAT rate
recently.
Right,
that was 2018, and then 9% corporate tax recently.
You've got a corporate tax, yeah. We've heard a couple of reasons why that might be from various people here. I think mainly it's been due to the outside world leaning on them.
The pressure of this minimum corporate tax.
Right. So, which shows you that the other side of the spectrum doesn't like to see places like the UAE pull all this business and intelligence and creativity into its kind of like sphere.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, they're going to do what they can to stem the bleeding, right? They're trying to stop the brain drain, right, as we were talking about. But it's not going to be effective. I think there will always be some regions that want to do things different to others, right? And there will, you know, I think this is why people, they get this idea in their mind of like, oh, hey, let's have a minimum corporate tax, because in their mind, it's wrong for some other place to be unjustifiably low tax or something. And they're wrong. They're just quite simply wrong. There are reasons why different countries want to offer low tax and low regulations. And so I think we're just going to see this continual sort of competition there. The other point really is that in a world with 8 billion people and almost 200 countries, there's always going to be places who want to do things differently and people who don't agree with other people, right? Even inside countries, right? Like North Italians are different from South Italians or whatever. Like there's all kinds of people who today you would count them as in one flag or under one country, but actually you could split that up even further. And so I think we are going to see this trend of more jurisdictions, right? Like coming back to that stat. Now, I don't know the exact number, but I've heard after World War II, I think there were about 85 countries. As we speak today, in 2024, I think that number is more like 190 or 195, something like that. And I think it's going to continue in that direction. And so people, sometimes they get it in their mind that, oh, you know, secession or new countries, it's not a thing that happens often. But I mean, it does. It quite literally, it does happen. I mean, we've seen the creation of all these new countries. Even recently, things like Serbia and Montenegro, or Czechoslovakia, and now it's Czechia and Slovakia. You know, the USSR splitting up. We're going to see more and more of that. And I think that also plays into this sort of free private cities and free zones conversation too.
Is there? Do you think there's an advantage to being a smaller country then?
Yes, absolutely.
In what way?
So you can move more nimbly. I think you can be more nimble. And here's the other thing. If we're thinking about customers, think about if you're trying to offer a service to your customers, it helps if you're closer to them, right? Think about the other opposite end, right? If you're talking about the USA, this mega super state, the world's most powerful government that's ever existed, and you have these bureaucrats and these legislators in Washington, D.C. regulating people who live thousands of kilometers away from them, it's just not realistic, right? It's not aligned with how the people would like to be governed. And I think that's why there's an advantage for smaller states and for smaller regions to outcompete in that way. And so for a few reasons, I think smaller states have advantages. Now, it's not a guarantee, it's not an ironclad, you know, yeah, of course there could be a small state that's tyrannical and evil and whatever, but it's speaking in terms of tendencies, smaller states, I think, can offer more liberty and can offer alternatives, right? Because if you are in a very large state, or let's go even to the extreme. Let's say you're in a one world government. There was nowhere else you could go, right? Okay, or let's say now we're talking about the example where maybe it's one big state and you live like right here and your family's right here. For you to go to another state, it's 4 hours flight. It's just too far away. But if you think about now, okay, what if there was lots of small states and you could cross the border quite easily to some other state and work there and come back, and it's not that far from your family now. So it just makes it easier. And large states tend to have this big surveillance and control infrastructure, whereas smaller states tend to not be able to afford that, or just not, it's not that feasible for them. So it's not perfect, but I think smaller states, smaller is better in that way. And so coming back to that idea, what we were talking about before about the Overton window being expanded and this idea of having, you know, many small states, whether it's Singapore and Dubai and, I don't know, Monaco and whatever. If we're going to have lots of these, that could be a really interesting thing for, you know, humanity to go down that direction.
Do you have an opinion on how you see the future of special economic zones evolving from what you know?
So I think it's not a very well understood concept, right? If you talk to the average man on the street and you're like, hey, what's a special economic zone? I mean, maybe here in Dubai, he might, you know, but like if you talk about most of the world, if you just talk to a random man on the street and be like, hey, what's a special economic zone? Do you know one? They might not even be able to tell you, right? They might, you know, at best be able to name Dubai or, you know, Hong Kong or something. I don't know. Probably not, right? That's where we are. But that's also part of where if the idea can be made popular, then more people can sort of look at that as an example and be like, oh, hey, look what they did in Hong Kong or in Singapore or whatever, and sort of see, okay, yeah, maybe there is a reason. Look how low they were before and look how high they are now, right? And for that example to be popularized, and I think that, you know, that could help. But yeah, I think coming back to what we were saying before in terms of what's the future of some of these, yeah, I think the legal innovation aspect of it might be another future element of it. This idea of having, put it this way, having an outside mediator or arbitrator instead of this idea of the state being the ultimate rulemaking and, you know, court authority to be able to rule on cases, not just between its subjects, between the subject and itself. And that's the world we're in, you know, for most of the world today. But eventually, if we could get to a state where states have to go to an outside court, then I think that would also be really interesting and really powerful from a liberty perspective. And then that could, you know, again, bringing it back to win-win-win for everybody, that could enable better service delivery and better customer service and better, you know, treating people like customers instead of treating them like tax cattle.
What's your opinion on autonomy in general? And I mean, one of the aspects of free zones and special economic zones is a degree of autonomy from the government. You know, what's your sweet spot on autonomy?
Yeah, hard to say. I think the challenge in a democratic system will often be what the other people think, right? If they can be whipped up and riled up into, you know, getting angry. Here I'm thinking of Honduras, right? I'm thinking of like how the Honduran people can sort of be whipped up into a frenzy about, oh, you know, and they'll say various arguments about, oh, look what these people are doing on Roatan in Prospera or whatever. Or maybe some of the more leftist organizations internationally will sort of criticize and try to sort of help the socialist cause. So, you know, where does it all land? Yeah, I think it's going to be hard to sort of make that case, but that's the case people have to make of like, yeah, let people have the right to choose how they would like to live. And this is coming up all around the world, right? Even in America, I'm thinking the quote-unquote national divorce conversation and secession and should states be allowed to secede, right? Because a lot of people will instantly think, oh, civil war, whatever, you know. But the funny thing with that is they think that just because people fought a war hundreds of years ago, that has implications on, you know, what people should be doing now. And don't forget, America seceded illegally from the UK, right? So the formation of the country was quote unquote illegal. So I think it just comes down to more principled arguments around why do you support secession or support smaller states or economic zones. The idea is you're trying to give people the right to choose for themselves instead of, you know, you need to be forced to live under this governance, democratic governance system that we have decided for you. And don't worry, if you're a minority and you're constantly always going to get voted against in any democratic thing, we're going to protect you with these other protections. But actually, those other protections just fade over time anyway, right? Just as we spoke about this idea that, oh, the Supreme Court will protect you, but actually they won't, because we'll just choose different people who go on that court and they will decide against you and you'll never be able to vote for your own freedom. You'll just be stuck as a permanent minority. Well, maybe that permanent minority might decide, hey, yeah, I want to go live in a free private city, or hey, I want to secede. We want to be able to decide what we do. And so, you know, the full libertarian, full autonomous answer is to secede right down to the right of the individual, would be the hypothetical, a world with 8 billion governments, per se. Now, will we ever get there? I don't know. I think it's more likely that we live in a world with many, many city states. I think that's the likely outcome.
Just for the last 20 minutes or so, let's move on to Bitcoin.
Yeah, sure.
There's a lot been going on this year. Can you sum up the major developments in 2024? Because like I say, I think we're having one of those years, aren't we? There's been a few pivotal years. Or we were talking about this on another recent podcast, and I was thinking about big events in the Bitcoin journey that cause new paradigms. I think we're going through one now.
Yeah, so I think the ordinals inscriptions stuff has driven fees up, and then that's forced more of a conversation around who can afford to use the chain. And I think more and more people are sort of being aware now that not everybody on earth can afford to use the chain. And we don't know what technology will come. We don't know if there'll be a block size increase. I would say it's unlikely. It's possible, but very unlikely in my view, as an example. But there's maybe now more conversation around what other technologies, what other soft forks, what other things could be done to sort of improve that. But at the same time, there's also another way of thinking about it. Like, you could just say, look, I'm sorry, not everybody on earth can use the chain. And there will be custodial services. If it, you know, assuming adoption increases, and I think all the indicators are that adoption is going to increase, right? Like whether it's, you know, people, yeah, of course, there's all these people coming into ETFs and so on, but there's, you know, there's these new circular economies around the world. There's more and more people learning, coming to platforms like Swan or others, and they're buying and they're self-custodying their Bitcoin. But eventually we're going to hit levels where not everyone can afford to realistically do that, and there's going to be people who use custodial platforms. So that's where maybe last mile, you know, custodial Bitcoin banking will exist. Now, the original promise of Bitcoin is be your own bank and everyone can do it. But as we're saying, it doesn't look like everyone will be able to do that. So there'll be a lot of people who are using some kind of custodial thing, some kind of federated custodial thing like Liquid, or maybe it's like Fedimint or something like that. Like these, and then these mints or these lightning banks, let's call them, will interface with each other using lightning. I think that's the likely, at least as we speak today, that seems the likely outcome.
I think I've thought that for a number of years now. Just the sort of layered money approach to Bitcoin. I think it seems pretty uncontroversial as well. I agree. I was a bit disappointed to think that maybe Freedom Money wouldn't be Freedom Money or the base chain forever. But the truth of the matter is, like you say, is this is a free market of ideas in the Bitcoin space, and whatever people choose to do is what happens, and that appears to be the outcome. So I think that's right. I think the outcome is right because it's being chosen by the consensus. What do you think about the future of the layered spectrum on Bitcoin? I mean, do we end up with thousands of layers in the end?
They are all moderated by your ability to access layer one, right? And I think sometimes people get it in their head of like layer one, layer two, layer three, four. It's more like every layer two, in order to be a true layer two, and this, I guess part of this comes to the definition. How do we define layer two? I think most people are seeing it like you need unilateral exit, the ability to exit without asking permission from the other person or from somebody else. And so Lightning meets that definition. Maybe state chains, like what the Mercury layer guys are doing as an example. But right now, there's probably not other true L2s or layer 2s. And the challenge what we're talking about, the challenge we're dealing with here is you need to be able to access the chain in order to use that thing permissionlessly. And as just kind of back of the envelope numbers, right? If you say each Bitcoin block has 4,000 transactions in it and you do the maths, it's like 210 million transactions per year, something in that range. That doesn't allow for a lot of on-chain use. And even in a lightning world, you still will periodically need to open or close a channel or do a splice on-chain transaction. In practice, that out of that 210 million transactions, it might only allow, people say 10 to 100 million entities, but it might be closer to like 10 or 20 million, you know? Because once you think about like, even for me today, like I might've done like a transaction from this hardware wallet into my Lightning wallet, and that's like an on-chain transaction, right? Like, so if we're moving into that world, you know. Now, to be fair, that 210 million transactions we spoke about, there is batching possible. So it could be like one transaction, but actually it opens like 5 channels or 10 channels or whatever. So there's certain batching things we can do. But yeah, point being, the layers will be restricted by how many people can actually access the chain. Now, can people build custodial layers? Okay, yeah, that's a different thing.
Doesn't the layered approach, and I don't know enough about this, but doesn't the layered approach, won't it suffer from just another iteration of fees rising? doesn't what's happening on the base chain now, which as we can see, and if as price rises, transactions become less affordable if you have a small amount of Bitcoin.
Yes.
Doesn't that start happening on L2 eventually? I don't know the actual software implications of it.
Sort of. I think it kind of comes down to how those L2s are set up and how the participants on that L2 are working, right? Like if you're an L2 and you have big channels and you just sort of, you know, then maybe it's okay. But you still got to think about the cost of capital.
Even the opening of the channel.
Yeah.
I mean, in 30 years' time, it might cost you like $100,000 to open a Lightning channel.
Maybe. Who knows? Maybe a burger costs $20,000. I'm joking. But we joke, right? But in certain countries of the world, yeah, like if you go to Indonesia or Vietnam or Colombia, they have very high denominations, or Japan even. Yeah. Right, you need to, it's like 30,000 yen or whatever it is. Anyway, back to the point though about cost of operating a Lightning node and Lightning channels. Yeah, I think it comes down to what we were saying, right? At current technology, current constraints, it's probably something like 10 to 50 million people globally out of a world of 8 billion people and 300 million entities like corporates and whatever. We're going to say, loosely speaking, the richest 10 to 50 million can actually afford to hit the chain. So yeah, that basically implies a lot of Lightning banks existing and maybe only the high net worth people who can actually afford to hit the chain.
And also a whole industry will rise up based around keeping fees low on the base chain. I mean,
as in batching things and collaborating.
Whatever. I was talking to Max Hillebrand about this about a year ago. There'll be a million and one ways to try and save fees on the base chain, unlike now when, I mean, you try and get a cheap fee, but you're not too bothered. It's $2, $3, $4.
We've been living in Satoshi's subsidy era.
Yes.
And that's the way Bob Burnett frames it as well. And there's truth to that, right? Like in 2009 to 2024, we've had it cheap, and we've been lucky. Eventually, it's gonna flip, and you're gonna have to pay quite a bit in fees. But I think the interesting thing would be, will the fees may rise in real purchasing power terms, but in Bitcoin Satoshi terms, they may actually come down over time. Hmm. They may trend down because that's the scarcity, right? So in real purchasing power terms, yeah, it's gonna get expensive.
One interesting thing as well, there's quite a number of Bitcoin UTXOs might get stuck.
They will be uneconomical to spend. Yeah, yes. They'll become effectively dust. Yeah.
Which is a strange concept, and I'm more certain that some very bright minds will come together to try and solve that, but I don't know how you do from currently.
It may just be that they're kind of left, it's like a wasteland, you know, they're just kind of the wasteland
donations
of dust
to
UTXOs.
Yeah, but dust these days is like, you know, a tenth of a cent. We might be talking about like $20,000 dust, $40,000 dust. You know, someone's going to work on it to try and release it. But
it's kind of like the definition of it though is that it's uneconomical to spend it.
What about splitting micro satoshis? Wouldn't that solve the problem?
The point here, what we're talking about here is those dust UTXOs, like that's why they're called dust. It's because they're too low to spend. And so I don't know if, actually Dhruv Bansal wrote from Unchained Capital, he wrote a blog series, I think it was called Dust in the Engine, something like this. This is like back in 2018 or 2019. He was writing about this idea of dust, dust outputs. The main thing I would say is people just need to get their houses in order now to be ready for that future and make sure you're kind of dealing with larger UTXO sizes.
Might be worth just explaining what you mean by that, consolidating UTXOs.
Right.
Just put it in basic terms just in case anyone's listening
about? In simple terms, a UTXO is an unspent transaction output. Every time you send Bitcoin transactions, you're kind of consuming it and creating new outputs. It's like you're melting down the gold and recasting those into new gold bars. But the point here is each coin or each UTXO, you want to make sure that your UTXOs at a minimum are 1 million sats. I think that's like a good rule of thumb. Minimum, have your UTXOs at 1 million satoshis per coin. And then that means on a per UTXO basis, you're kind of relatively safe. But you should go higher than that if you can. There is a privacy trade-off to that, but at the same time, you have to balance the economics, the efficiency with the privacy.
And the privacy trade-off is that you may combine, basically you're trying to take all your very small denominations of Bitcoin on the chain and consolidate them together. But if you consolidate transactions from completely different periods of your life, you're basically revealing to whoever wants to look at the chain that all these things belong to you.
We're related, yeah.
And so it's a dance. It's a tightrope walk that you walk, but probably it's worth doing, as you say. If you're thinking long term, you may not care. If you're worried about 1 million Satoshi's UTXOs, when in 40 years you may be so rich you don't care anyway. So
maybe you're just like whatever. I mean, who knows?
What about ETFs? Certainly, they've added a very strong layer of legitimacy to Bitcoin. That's the general sense, I think.
Yeah, a lot of people are saying, look, BlackRock is doing it now. And the reality is we are a social creature. We're a social being. And so we often, and I say we, I'm just kind of summarizing, I'm just talking in general, people look at who they see as high status and they copy those people or they try to be like them, right? Whether it's Kim Kardashian or Cristiano Ronaldo or whatever, like people are looking at that. And so in the financial world, oh, it's BlackRock, it's Fidelity, what are they doing? And I think that gives this perception, right? This perception of, hey, Bitcoin is okay now. Hey, I can do this thing now. And now they have an easy way to access it. And so I'm hearing the demand is, it's been huge. When you think about how much money has been flowing in through these Bitcoin ETFs. Now, of course, I would rather people bought, real Bitcoin instead of buying IOU later on top of an IOU. But nevertheless, a lot of people are putting in their money through this, and that is going to, drive a lot more interest. And I think it's going to drive a lot more conversations all around the world, whether it's at the government level or at the, large corporate level, whether it's at the fund management level, family office, high net worth, everyday pleb, everyday retail person, it's going to drive those conversations all around the world of what am I doing to save my money? And instead of doing my silly 60-40 stocks and bonds thing, maybe it's time to start thinking about Bitcoin and what allocation to Bitcoin am I going to do? And it won't even just be, do I do Bitcoin or not? It's what allocation do I go for? Are you going for a conservative 80% or an aggressive 90%? I'm joking. I think it's interesting to see, I'll give you an example here. From what I've heard, BlackRock hosted a seminar to sort of educate their people about the Bitcoin ETF and what kind of allocation. And even BlackRock was sort of trying to push people more towards, I think 4 or 5% is much better than 1 or 2%, that kind of thing. They were trying to say that. And then later they sort of came out with, these other numbers. And
well, I think 1% were, that's back when Saylor started stacking was the 1% day. I think most people are saying 4 or 5%.
Yeah. For sure.
That by its nature has to keep increasing as the price goes up.
Yeah.
And it's almost, it's undeniable that the existence of now the ETFs and the fact that they're backed by real Bitcoin is what's causing the price to rush. Right now, we've never seen an all-time high before the halving.
Yeah.
So it must, according to me at least, it must be that. And as the price rises, like you say, more people become interested. And
yeah, exactly.
Especially at the institutional level.
Because ultimately, you have to get to that individual first, right? Michael Saylor had to kind of orange pill himself first before he could then go, get the rest of his board and his C-suite on board, and then MicroStrategy could do it. And he was probably in a unique spot because he is the co-founder and holds a lot of the voting stock of MicroStrategy, kind of relating even back to the democracy versus monarchy point, right? This kind of the monarch can decide something and just make it happen, and he can make it stick. Whereas a democratic elected leader can get voted out, and they can change the policy. And maybe that's what we saw in Honduras as an example.
Well, it's happening at some of the banks. Or was it some of the investment banks that aren't issuing ETFs? Sound like the board is kind of voting against this idea, even though some people may be, and I'm sure possibly they all own it individually. What I've really acknowledged this year is that Bitcoin as a savings technology has been a massive meme. And it always has been. It's always been there. But suddenly, it's really true. And especially as you, obviously, because we're in a sort of prices rising, and Bitcoin is a phenomenal store of value over time. If you're a forced seller after a year or after 6 months or whatever,
yeah,
it may absolutely not be. But once you see a sort of 4 to 5 year period out, you realize what a phenomenal store of value it is. And now it really is happening again. And because we're seeing very high levels of inflation, I know everyone now who's not speaking about inflation as something that they've kind of heard everyone's talking about. It's that they've actually seen it in the shops.
Yeah.
Even the bar of chocolate that used to cost 90 cents is $1.50 now. It's really happening. And you know that you can't insulate yourself against inflation with many things as liquid as something like Bitcoin. And I think, I don't know what you think, is that, do you think that's true? Fair to say that particular aspect of the Bitcoin, the benefits of Bitcoin is really starting to show its head now?
Yeah, it's really shining through now. I think many of us have been arguing as, you know, Bitcoin as savings technology. Shout out to my friend Pierre Richard for that for years. But it takes repetition to get through, right? Because what a bunch of us internet nerds were arguing about, you know, for years online doesn't necessarily flow through to the conversation about, you know, financial advisors are having, or even the man on the street is having when he's buying, you know, food at the store. It's absolutely starting to happen. And, you know, in years gone by, we used to get pushback that, oh, see, Bitcoin is not an inflation hedge, blah, 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 because look at this time period. And it always comes down to kind of cherry picking the time periods. But I also like the framing of my friend Parker Lewis. He says, hey, Bitcoin is not an inflation hedge. It's the solution, right? That's really what we're talking about. It's not just an inflation hedge. It's a solution to the problem of fiat currency. And so I think over time, these ETF buyers will go down the process themselves, right? Like they might start with, okay, it's just a ticker. Let me buy my 5% or whatever IBIT or whatever ticker they buy. And eventually, you know, in a year or two, they might have gone in at 5% allocation, but after a year, it might be 40%. And now they'll be like, whoa, this thing is now 40% of my portfolio. I better do some more reading about it. Okay, let me listen to some podcasts. Let me read some books about this thing. Oh, okay, there's actually this whole like reasoning around why money should be separate from the state and why sound money is a good thing and scarcity is a good quality for money to have, etc. All of these conversations, and why does it matter that it's decentralized and it's robust and it's scalable and accessible and all of these things. And eventually they'll sort of start to be like, yeah, I need to get some outside of the ETF. I need to get some that I hold. And you know what? Even in the future, we may start to see that conversation too, that people can have in-kind redemption out of the ETF. And I know in other countries, and now in the USA they don't, they've got this cash creates idea, but in other countries they were exploring that idea of having, like, you could buy the ETF and then later you could actually take it out into your own hardware wallet or multi-sig, etc. And so
how would that work though? Because the ETF is a product. I mean, I don't actually know what, actually no, I don't even know. What is the ETF comprised of? Is it like,
We're probably going beyond my level here, but in terms of what I know. But I think my understanding of it would just be that you could sort of close out your account with that ETF and withdraw the Bitcoin.
What I mean is, if you buy, normally, often ETFs are, you know, basket of different things.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you buy like one Bitcoin's worth of Bitcoin ETF, what are you buying? A basket of one Bitcoin?
Well, I mean, it's an IOU of an IOU.
Is it? It's literally that.
because you're buying whatever, BlackRock or Fidelity or whatever, and then in reality they have an account with, you know, Coinbase or whatever, and then Coinbase is the one, Coinbase Custody's team is actually the one holding the underlying Bitcoin. So you've got like two levels of IOU.
I didn't think it through because it sounds so stupid now when you think about it, when you could just go buy the Bitcoin.
But I mean, it sounds silly when we say this, right? But the reality is the typical person who's not a Bitcoiner, who's not like us, they're sitting there with their E-Trade, whatever, terminal, Charles Schwab, whatever, and they just want to be able to type in IBIT or HODL or FBIT or whatever the different codes are. They just want to be able to type that into the platform that they've already done KYC, they've already got it set up, it already has all the same kind of inheritance planning and all this other stuff set up on this brokerage account. That's what all of this was, you know? Of course, they could have come to Swan or to Coinbase or to whatever, you know, whatever, big exchange and bought it there, but most of them were just not willing to go that far. And also the narrative, the media, that, you know, it just wasn't, the hype wasn't there.
Of course, we keep tapping on all-time highs again in price, and as a result, there are some very wayward price predictions happening on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think about all that?
So, I mean, I'll say this. I think people are putting too much into like these charting models, right? And I think it's better to just think in terms of what markets can Bitcoin displace, right? Gold, bonds, stocks, property, like physical property. And think, you know, what percent is Bitcoin going to take out of there, right? And I think, for me, at least this cycle, now, again, obvious disclaimer, I don't have a crystal ball, right? But I could see something like mid six figures this cycle. I could see that. To me, it's plausible, put it that way. I could be wrong. And to be clear, it could be like mid six figures and then we take an 80% drop, you know? So, you know, just as is tradition, we do a big run up and then we take an 80% drop, as we've done, you know, 2014, 2018, you know, 2022, like we just, you know, that's kind of the cycle of how things go, right? I think we've got a few of these cycles to go. And so I'm sort of, the way I think about it is, you know, I'm regularly accumulating Bitcoin, but I'm ready for an 80% drop because I've lived through multiple of those and I see that as that's a likely thing to happen again. But yeah, so I think one thing I would say is I think last cycle was maybe a little bit muted because of the China mining ban and because of, you know, paper coins with FTX and so on. I think we didn't get as much NGU number go up as we quote unquote should have or otherwise would have. And so I think that was causing a lot of people to sort of undershoot their expectation for this cycle. So yeah, as I said, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think mid six figures is, you know, plausible. We could get to the range of gold-ish, which I think at current day prices is maybe 700,000, something like that. But yeah, we could hit that level and then crash down below it. And then Peter Schiff will do his victory lap of, oh, see, look how stupid you are. Bitcoin's gone from 600,000 down to 100,000. You're all a bunch of idiots. It's going to zero. But nevertheless, you know, we keep stacking and just keep doing it again. And some percentage of those people who got wrecked on the way down, they go, you know, they listen to Stefan Levera podcast or they read the Bitcoin Standard or they, you know, they learn about some of these concepts and then they become a new hodler. They become a real hodler instead of being like a tourist, you know.
I saw some interesting charts yesterday from someone who was monitoring outflows from the ETFs and it looks like we're having a bit of a dip at the moment and people are, you know, already selling that dip in the classic sense.
Even there people were arguing some. I think Eric Balchunas from Bloomberg was trying to go the other way saying, no, it's actually the ETF guys who are buying now. So yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but anyway, go on.
But what I mean is I like to hear that even institutions and they still, you know, buy the top and sell the bottom.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there will be institutions will make the same mistakes individuals make. You know, institutions can be as degenerate. Maybe not quite as degenerate, but yeah, they can be. And so, you know, they some of them will sort of buy an amount and get wrecked, and there'll be a bunch who spend time underwater because they bought the top. We're gonna go through all of that again, and it's gonna be another round of like, oh, look how stupid your Bitcoiners were, da, 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 whatever, it's all over this time, it's a bubble, it's crashed now, it's never coming back. All the same things will happen again.
My favorite ever Michael Saylor quote is, I'll be buying the top forever.
I think
that's a phenomenally deep and meaningful statement when you're a Bitcoiner, because I think part of your journey has to be buying the top, sitting underwater for a bit, getting through it, probably through two cycles, and then realizing, I don't give a fuck.
Right. Yeah. Once you've gone through a few rounds of it, you're kind of like, all right.
It becomes second nature.
Yeah.
He's an absolute gold mine of memes.
He's
really quite incredible, Michael Saylor, when you think about it. I don't want to turn someone into a hero too much, because you know you'll have to tear him down at some point. But he really is a stalwart proponent and advocate, and you know, actually doing it. I mean, really, really putting your money where your mouth is. Quite astonishing, really.
Yeah, I think he's put in, absolutely, as you said, put his money where his mouth is, and he knows how to hodl. Like, he's proven to everybody he knows how to hodl through a big drawdown and keep stacking all the way through. And so...
Have you got any worries about Michael Saylor and anything? I know some people think that some of his theories on what Bitcoin is, what money is, you know.
Yeah. I mean, some people criticize on certain things, like certain analogies he might make. But the funny thing is, they try to say, oh, look, see, he's saying it's whatever, energy or whatever thing. But actually, from an engineering perspective, it's not that, or a physics. It's like the man is a literal aerospace engineer. Do you think he doesn't understand? Or he's run a software company for how many decades? You think he doesn't, like, understand software? Like, it's, you know, sometimes people are maybe taking a message that's designed for the new people and then treating it as though that's meant to be, like, technically precise for the... you know, for the hardcore people. It's like, no, there's analogies that you can use to sort of bring new people in. And sometimes those analogies will necessarily not be perfect. And that's just the way of the world. That's life. People won't learn otherwise.
I've never actually got to speak to him, actually. But I do really want to interview him one day, because I'd never seen anyone really ask him about his actual long game with respect to... why? What are you going to do with all this Bitcoin, right? Because when I look at him and I look at other things that he's doing, he'll probably, well, if it carries on as it does, he'll become one of the richest people on the planet.
Yeah.
And I've often wondered whether he's not thinking that he's going to, for example, take his education platform, free education for everyone. I mean, imagine if you're the richest guy on the earth and you really care about that, you could just educate the world for free. You could imagine how much money you could pump into that. Have you ever spoken to him about what his actual long game is? Because he's kind of always saying, yeah, I'm never selling, but you wouldn't just sit around and be the richest man in the world, and you wouldn't even sit around and plan a business around making more money necessarily. It would almost certainly occur to me at some point, which he's obviously thought of. How do I change the world? I've got all this ability. And I just see the education platform as possibly one of those things. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't actually know. I've never asked him kind of at that level of, like, what are you going to do with the coins? I mean, you know, you might have seen, like, the, you know, meme shared or whatever. Or I think he said some clips have gone online where he said, like, you know, die with the coins or something like that.
He would die with the coins.
Yeah, well, I think one answer, I think one podcast, I think he was going into this explanation of how he was saying it was like, this would be like a really charitable thing, or this could be something to just literally just die with the coins and let them, you know.
I think that would be really disappointing, don't you? I mean, but who would you give them to? I mean,
yeah,
what a curse. Like, that amount of money could be an absolute curse as well. But
yeah,
the thing is, the thing I find interesting is he's a very astute guy, obviously, and I do trust him, you know, to actually, he's a moral guy, it appears. He's a kind of, I never met him, I don't know what goes on in his private life, but when you listen to somebody that much, you kind of get a sense of who they are, don't you? I there's a part of me that really hopes that he does do some incredibly philanthropic things. And like the one that springs to mind instantly is the education thing, because he has this education program. And I know that their plan is to give free education to everyone, you know. Well, if you ever speak to him next time, ask him.
Yeah, I mean, my read, I haven't directly asked him about that, but I mean, my understanding of, I guess the way I see it is like, I'm guessing he would just sort of view it like, look, it's an online platform. What we want is education available to everybody. And now all you need is a computer to access that. And then boom, now you can like learn all this stuff, whether it's Bitcoin things or physics or other topics that they have on there. Or business related topics, and that's it. Like, it's just there as a resource to sort of prove that you can do these things online, right? This kind of dematerializing things, as he's spoken about, or he was famous for the mobile wave, right? Like, kind of seeing this trend of like, hey, the world is going to smartphones and mobile devices, and investing in, you know, Apple and the other companies that he invested in. So I think that's my, if I had to guess what his view is, I don't know that.
What would you do with 200,000 Bitcoin?
Set up a citadel. Set up citadels around the world. have a citadel network, and try to prove that free markets work. You know, I think that would that could be something that could really.
Really, would you? Like, think honestly, if you had 200,000.
If I had 200,000 Bitcoin, yeah, I'd look at, yeah, what citadels can I set up, and can I, I think that may be the direction the world is going anyway. Like, we may see that it's just going to be like, kind of like city state, kind of, you know.
You reckon his Miami pad might become a citadel? Or the boat, maybe he'll get into seasteading.
Well, seasteading, yeah. Maybe he's going to be a big seasteading guy. I don't know. No, I mean, I don't know if he's as into kind of the,
The freedom stuff,
the free cities aspects of it.
No, the freedom stuff. He must be into liberty.
I mean, he's mentioned he's a fan of Herbert Spencer. The moon is a harsh mistress, or is it Frank Herbert? Sorry, Frank Herbert. The moon is a harsh mistress, which is I think it's a well. I haven't actually read it myself, but I've heard it's like a libertarian thing. And he considers himself, you know, into Austrian economics. So presumably he likes, you know, free markets. We'll see. I mean, it's hard to say.
Yeah. Well, listen, I won't take you any longer. It's been a good chat. Nice to see you again in Dubai. Last time we spoke was in El Salvador, I think.
Yeah.
Two very similar places, but... Thanks again, Stefan, for coming in, and thanks for hearing your words of wisdom again, and I hope to see you another time.
No worries. Thanks for having me.